Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. Well, they say that we should climb mountains, not so the world can see you, but that so you can see the world. But tonight's stories may just make us change our minds about that. Three tales from the Rocky Mountains for you this evening. Later on, we have You Look Like My Son by Honer Ataxia. We round off tonight's stories with Sharp Rock by Nicholas Nichols. But before that, we have Colorado Fishing Trip by Liam Vickers. Now, as ever, before we begin, a note of caution. Tonight's stories may contain strong language as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin.
Our trip started in late February, as my three friends, John, Steve, Max, and I, drove in my truck deep into the backwoods of Boxwood Gulch to follow the North Fork of the South Platte River. Steve owns a cabin up in the backcountry, so we left my truck there and began our 57-mile hike into the wooded terrain following the river. We had all of our camping and fishing gear packed, and enough food to, hopefully, last us the 3-day journey both ways. As we set out in the early morning, a few light snowflakes began to fall. The terrain was heavily wooded and uneven, making for slow going. The cool mountain air rustled through the trees, and sunlight streamed through the canopy, making the snowflakes glint and shimmer as birds chirped overhead and the river babbled in the distance. It was going to be a near-perfect trip. We stopped for a rest a few hours in. The weather had been slowly worsening since we'd left, but it was only then that we realized how bad it had gotten. The snow was whipping around us in a blinding flurry as the wind howled, making the trees creak and sway, almost threatening to snap them in two. The ground had already accumulated a good 6 inches of snow. It was about midday, but the sky was black. And I don't mean dark due to the ever-intensifying storm. I mean that in between the gaps in the clouds, there was no blue, just solid black. None of us really made a note of it at the time, as it was hard to notice through the thick cascade of snow and the limited visibility. After continuing on our hike for some time, however, it became all too apparent that something was wrong. In addition to the sky, we also realized that there was nothing in the distance. There should have been some mountains or something like there had been at the start, but no matter which way we turned, the world only seemed to extend 50 or so feet around us. Then it disappeared into the blizzard. It was nighttime now, or at least it was dark out, but it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. As we walked forward, new things slowly came into view, but everything behind us disappeared, and although we could progress further, we couldn't seem to double back. Once we left something behind us, we couldn't reach it again. Steve had forgotten his lighter a little while back when we stopped to eat, but when we tried to turn around and go back, we were greeted by a wall of snow and fog, impossible to see through. Our flashlight's beams didn't penetrate the fog. They stopped as they hit it, as if it was a physical wall. Curious, Steve reached out and moved his hand into the fog. First his fingertips, then his whole hand disappeared into the haze. We all stood in disbelief, looking at the wall, which was impossibly tall and extended as far as we could see. There was no real gradient to it. Things didn't fade into the distance. There was a clear line where the wall began, and nothing was visible beyond that point. We were making a note of this when Steve muttered something. "What was that?" I asked. I can't feel my hand," he said slowly, as if realizing it as he said it. Puzzled, he retracted his hand slowly, and then screamed. His glove was shredded, almost disintegrated, and his hand looked like it had been forced through a wood chipper. Deep gashes revealed white bone underneath, and what fingers were left were stripped clean. We all panicked. Oh God, this is bad," Max cried. Steve simply stood, clutching what was left of his hand and hyperventilating. We had to get him to a hospital or he would certainly bleed to death. But we were almost a day's walk from Steve's cabin, which was already remote enough. We were all frantically checking our phones for a signal when the worst happened. Steve fainted. His eyes closed, his legs buckled, and he fell forward into the fog. None of us noticed at first, but when we finally did, all we could see were his legs protruding through the mist. We immediately, without thinking, rushed to pull him out. We grabbed his legs and strained to drag him back into view. Before we even saw him, however, we immediately regretted doing so. We somehow knew what we would find. The thing we dragged out was not Steve. Not anymore. All of his skin was cleaved off. His ribcage ripped open, with his entrails spilling out. And his face, it haunts me to this day. Not merely because it was horrendously mutilated. Not merely because his eyes had been torn out, leaving only empty sockets. But because it smiled at me. A big, wide smile that started small, but the gashes in his face allowed it to literally stretch from ear to ear. Max screamed and shoved Steve's mangled body back into the fog. We ran as fast as we could, the only way we could, deeper into the woods. Just as before, the snow and fog parted before us, but swallowed up everything we left behind. As we ran and ran, the scenery around us began to slowly change. The trees surrounding us were now withered and dead. The grass was flattened and bleached. In fact, everything around us was dead. Colors had all but disappeared, leaving only shades of gray and an intensified feeling of loneliness and death. While we ran, I realized something. "Guys," I shouted while I ran, not daring to stop for even a minute. "We can't turn around and go straight back. But maybe we can circle around back to Steve's cabin. Then we can get the truck and get the hell out of here." John and Max nodded their heads and we turned 90 degrees right and continued running. Eventually we ran through what appeared to be a herd of deer, all of which were laying on the ground, gray and lifeless. Hacked to pieces, blood soaked on the ground. As we ran through the herd, dodging corpses, it was hard not to notice that their dead, lifeless eyes seemed to follow us. When we felt confident enough that we wouldn't be doubling back on ourselves, we turned towards Steve's cabin. Towards safety. We ran for at least another hour. Eventually, however, none of us could run any longer. Our bodies simply wouldn't allow it, and we were forced to stop. After some time, Max, John, and I managed to get a fire going, despite the snow and damp tinder. We had hoped that it would bring some sense of warmth and security. But we were wrong. The flames were a bright orange hue, bleeding some color into this gray-scale world. It clearly did not belong. Nor did we. The longer the flames crackled and popped, the more we began to hear something. Distant and quiet at first, but slowly growing closer, louder, and more numerous. A chorus of blood-curdling wails and moans soon filled the air around us. Focused on the fire and pretending to be safe, mesmerized by its beauty, we didn't immediately notice a mangled deer carcass slowly dragging itself out of the fog and into view. Nor did we notice the second, nor the third. Finally, we snapped out of our trance just in time to scramble to our feet in terror as a myriad different animal carcasses climbed out of the fog, drawn to the strange light of the fire. We were intruders in their world. I was paralyzed by fear, unable to breathe. I turned to my friends to find that they were no longer beside me. They had taken off running, leaving me behind. I turned around to run after them, but something grabbed me by the shoulder. I didn't need to turn around to know what it was. I could tell by the hand gripping my shoulder. A hand that looked like it had gone through a wood chipper. I flailed and managed to free myself before it could get a good grip on me, and I took off running. I didn't look back. No way did I want to see the face of what was once my friend. I could no longer see John or Max, and I assumed that they must have been ahead of me. But I was the one with the keys to the truck, and Steve had the keys to the cabin. They wouldn't be any safer if I couldn't meet up with them. So I ran and ran faster, and for longer than any human could possibly do so. Under normal circumstances. Finally, after God knows how long, I could faintly make out a structure in the distance. It was the cabin. I felt a twinge of hope. The wails continued to ring out in the night air, but I seemed to have a lead on them at the time. I reached the truck, unlocked it, and jumped inside. I scanned the area for Max or John, but could see neither. I couldn't just leave them, but I couldn't wait here forever either. I sat sweating and shaking nervously as the wails grew closer and louder. I had just about made up my mind to leave, when I could suddenly make out someone sprinting towards me. It looked like Max. I started up the truck and motioned for him to run faster. But for some reason, I found myself subconsciously pressing the lock button, locking all of the doors. My instinct told me that something was wrong. I looked down at my hands. They were shaking like crazy. I look back up and Max's horribly mutilated face was pressed up against the driver's window, staring at me, smiling. He was trying to open the door. I slammed my foot on the gas and drove off, shaking like a madman and holding back the vomit. As I drove home, the sky slowly brightened back up into a blue hue, and I could eventually see the sun breaking through the clouds. It was 9 in the morning. I began to see other cars on the road, and the people inside waved at me as I waved at them. Nice, normal people. I went straight home and asked my girlfriend to marry me. Just kidding. I'm sitting in my house now, door locked and barricaded, windows boarded up, and I'm writing this story. And I felt happy for the first time in a long time writing that ending. But that's not how it ended. I merely wish it worked out like that. The truth is, as I drove, the sky did not brighten up, the sun did not reappear, and the fog still surrounded me as it now surrounds my house. I hear wailing all around and knocks at my door constantly. And when I look through the peephole, all I ever see is something smiling at me. The stench of death is everywhere. The phone doesn't work. The TV and radio broadcasts nothing but static. And I hear the locks on my door being undone at night, and I must constantly keep watch and relock them. I'm simply waiting for the night they get into my house when I forget to check the door, or when they break through a window, or when I wake up in the middle of the night to see them next to me, their smiles inches away from my face.
Yo-ho-ho, gentlemen. The holidays came early here at Manscaped, the leading men's hygiene brand. Manscaped just launched new products, including their all-new ultra-premium body wash and a 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. It's time to give yourself, or someone who needs it, the gift of beautiful skin, hair, and balls this holiday season. Go to manscaped.com and use code CREEP, C-R-E-E-P, for 20% off, plus free shipping. Oh, jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up. The Manscaped Performance Package 4.0 includes the Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant, moisturizer, and toner. It's time to keep your North Pole feeling and smelling fresh. Well, the hygiene bundle will also come with a pair of Manscaped anti-chafing boxers that'll keep your junk feeling fresh all day. The perfect package for your perfect package. Manscaped is going beyond the groin with their new ultra-premium body wash. It's infused with aloe vera and sea salt to keep your skin feeling clean, nice, and moisturized. Well, 'tis the season to load up on Manscaped products. So get 20% off and free shipping with the code CREEP at manscaped.com. Yes, that's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Just use the code CREEP. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year.
My eyes are in a fervorous affair with the clock, and my focus is none the wiser. The police dispatcher is pleading for me to humor her inquiries, if for no reason other than to keep my consciousness afloat. It is so late, and today has been so challenging. Nevertheless, I'll gratify her with my story,
because I'm really in no mood to tell it again later. Mariam Cliffington happened into our photo center again today. These visits are becoming relentless, as are the innumerable poorly photoshopped images on her SanDisk flash drive. Every day, it's the same process. She perches at our photo kiosk, orders small batches of 5x7 and 4x6 photos, and crones over the photo printer as it squeals its mechanical protests. The unfortunate photo specialist on duty is then scolded by dear old Mariam as the color in my son's face is coming out too pale, and my granddaughter's dress looks smudged, too washed out, becomes as recitable as the Lord's Prayer. The project is then gifted to me, as I am the only one who receives her limited mercy. This is due in part because I'm the only one in the store qualified as a professional photo editor. I also look just like her son. At least, that's what she tells me every time she swoons over the photos I correct. I personally never saw the extreme resemblance. We have similar Hollywood-esque hairstyles. Dark stubble, light eyes and a fair complexion. But that's where the similarities end. Well, that's my general assumption. Truthfully, I have never met him. According to Mariam, they don't get along so well these days. Reportedly, her son has become what she calls a changed person after he split with his wife. That always seemed odd to me, because nearly every day, I'm draining the red out of a new family photo that she zealously adds in her novice Photoshop sessions. It seems the family often stays in touch. Today, we discuss more personal topics, such as my college degree and her family get-togethers. She told me she was celebrating her granddaughter Gracie's 5th birthday today, and was putting together a photo album and baked goodies to send her. Today's photos were of the girl from her previous birthday. She had straw blonde hair, her father's bright blue eyes, rosy red cheeks and a devilish grin that strongly reminded me of the girl from the movie Problem Child 2. When the topic turned to me being a graduate in multimedia design, she immediately began to give me the shakedown on my talents as a web developer. She wanted me to build a forum-based website just for her family. She wasn't fond of the public limelight social media granted, but wanted regular updates from her son, granddaughter, their prized show horses, and images from all the reunions they've had over the years. I'm not a fan of Mariam. She may treat me in a more humane manner than my colleagues, but she's always so bitter. She carries an air of importance about her that mismatches with who she is. Like a pug in a sweater made of silk. The last thing I want from a client is a beady pair of eyes reflected behind ancient, dark-rimmed tortoiseshell glasses, critiquing my every line of code with ignorant words laced with the smell of stale coffee and menthol cigarettes. Her grey-black hair is often wild and tangled, as if she was fleeing her home every morning to develop photos which contain the cure for cancer. Despite her lack of self-management, she saw herself as an expert in managing the talents of others. I inquired about the specifics of her family problems, but I assumed this attitude must cause the bulk of it. The sense of entitlement is something I don't blend well with. After endless barrages of questions about my rates, schedule, and ability to tutor her in Photoshop, I gave her my business card and told her to call me in a few weeks. Truthfully, I'm in my 2-week leave period and on my way to a better job, and this was a simple method to evade her until I would never have to see her again. She seemed content with my proposal and took my card. I told her to forward my congratulations to her granddaughter on a 5-year milestone. As she shuffled out of our store,
I looked again at the refuse pile of discolored prints. If her family is so dysfunctional, why does she bring in new pictures of her son and granddaughter every other day? Why, as a spitting image of the son she frequently quarrels with, am I so reasonably treated by her? Those suspicions came to fruition a few hours later when a 20-something couple dropped off a few rolls of 35mm film. They had matching black hair, the athletic builds of bicyclists, and eyes that reflected deep kindness, but an even deeper sense of fatigue. The lab's business was running slow today, so I was immediately able to process their order and begin development. The development process is always the same. I feed just enough of the raw film through a machine to attach it to a leader card, which is mechanically guided through the film processor. After it completes its voyage and the developed film is fed through, I place it on the scanner of our printing machine and check the frames digitally for color flaws and inconsistencies. The picture showed the young couple celebrating another birthday. A boisterous banner which read, "Happy Birthday, Mitch," hung above an electric blue neon minibar. The couple was shown holding beer bottles and laughing heartily. The entire set was quite like photos most young couples bring in. There was a sloppy drunken kiss here, someone air guitaring on a table there. I began to complacently press the print button after every 6 frames. Then, I noticed a picture of Mariam's son. Even though I'd never met him, I had seen that face often. It was a face that was branded into the back of my eyes like the bright red digits of a digital alarm clock in the first few moments of morning consciousness. I was intrigued that these two may also be familiar with the eccentric woman who both frowned upon and adored her family. As I was packing up their photos and bringing up their orders, I decided to make conversation. "So, you know Mariam Cliffington?" I asked casually. Silence. I glanced upward, and the glance became a fixture. A paleness and shock had matched the exhaustion they both wore in their eyes. "Are you okay? I recognized her son in your photos." The girl spoke, tears welling in her eyes. "That's our friend Mitch. Those photos were taken a few weeks ago. He passed last week. This order is for his funeral slideshow." Her boyfriend spoke next, clearly unsettled but retaining his composure, as he quickly recited what I am sure he has gotten used to explaining. "He and his daughter were found dead in Mariam's home last Sunday, poisoned. The police have been seeking her for questioning. Have you seen her recently?" I was floored. I'm rarely one to lose my cool, but I began tripping over my words like they were raised on a high wire. "Yes, she was in here a few hours ago. She said she was celebrating Gracie's 5th birthday. She's working on a new photo album. They were new photos." The girl spoke next. "We need to call the police immediately. Gracie's birthday was the Tuesday before they were found. They didn't enjoy visits with Mariam, but she insisted on being with them to celebrate." Call them, I did. I spent the rest of my shift plus 2 extra hours conversing with a police detective and the couple. He asked me to print out the information we had on Mariam, and if we had any idea of her whereabouts. They inquired about the frequency of her visits, the types of purchases she made from the rest of the store, her current appearance, and general abnormalities in her behavior. I gave them what they needed, along with surveillance footage from the cameras we'd hidden around the building. They gave me the direct line to their office and sent me off with my assurance that I would call them immediately if Mariam came into the shop again. The drive home felt relatively non-existent. The thoughts of what had occurred seemed to dominate my sense of time while on the road. Had this lady, who compared me to her own son, been responsible for his death, for the death of his daughter? Would I see her before the police? I arrived at my house in the same psychological state as when I'd left the store. I nearly broke my ankle while stumbling over a package that was placed in front of the entryway. I brought it inside, into the light, and saw that the sender's name was Mom. I wasn't sure what the occasion was, but I assumed it was a late Thanksgiving care package. Regardless, it was good to receive mail from her. I wasn't sure where her new apartment was. Now I had her address, 6312 Prospect Road. Inside the package was a tin box of cookies and a neatly wrapped rectangular gift. I hadn't gotten to eat lunch with all of the police activity, so I immediately started tanking through the cookies as if I'd also skipped my last 5 meals. After my 4th cookie, I decided to wipe the crumbs from my hands and see what the mystery gift was. I unceremoniously ripped the red and gold metallic paper off of what appeared to be a small photo album bound in black vinyl. I opened it with giddy curiosity and felt the blood empty from my face. It was a timeline of photos from Marion Cliffington's family. These weren't the fun family get-togethers I'd recrafted at the photo lab. I hadn't printed these at all. Page 1. Mitch and Gracie are propped against the arm of a tan leather sofa. Daughter wrapped in father's arms. Their eyes are sunken and rolled backwards, and their tongues are lolled out of their mouths in an unnatural brown color. There is dried spittle and yellow foam caught in Mitch's black stubble, and a mixture of blood and vomit on the front of Gracie's shirt. The blood vessels in their faces are a sickly blue, and their skin is pale and puffy. This photo is labeled, Tuesday. Happy birthday, Gracie. Page 2. The bodies are placed in a maroon 2013 Toyota RAV4. They've been cleaned up and posed. Mitch in the front seat, Gracie in the center back seat. Their skin has continued to swell, so their eyes are puffy slits. Their now purple lips have been sewn shut and side-stitched into makeshift smiles. One of Mitch's arms is placed on the wheel, the other propped against the passenger seat in a pathetic wave. The label, Wednesday. Taking Gracie to school. Page 3. The bodies are now dressed in swimsuits and are posed around a kiddie pool. Mitch had to be propped up in an unknown manner that is clearly hidden from the frame. He's on his knees at the edge of the pool in blue and white Hawaiian shorts. Gracie is in the pool, positioned on her belly in a striped pink one-piece bathing suit, with a matching swim skirt. Their hands are duct taped together, and their skin has taken on a sickly yellow color. They are starting to bruise and darken in areas in which they'd evidently been placed for too long. The label, Thursday, teaching Gracie to swim. Page 4. Mitch is now dressed in a handsome ivory tuxedo, which has a few off-color stains, where his skin is starting to split open. He's at his kitchen table with a full glass of white wine and a lit dining candle in front of him. The sleeves on his arms reveal dark bruising, where the tape was wrapped with his daughter's arms the day before. Gracie is not in this picture, but Mariam is. She's grasping one of his rotting hands in one of her own, with a brimming glass of red wine in the other. She wears a motherly smile that sickeningly matches the sewn-on smile of her lifeless son. The label, Friday, dinner with the boy. Page 5. Gracie is propped against the wall, the skin of her arms ripped off where the tape was 2 days prior. Her face is beginning to lose its humanity, but is now coated in makeup worthy of a Little Miss Sunshine pageant. Her straw blonde hair is curled and bouncy, and her artificial smile is beginning to tear along the stitching. Next to her is an assortment of porcelain dolls, each made up and dressed with care that is a bit too sophisticated for a 5-year-old girl. To the far left of the frame, Mariam's reflection could be seen in a full body mirror, pointing the camera at the twisted salon she constructed. The label, Saturday, Girls' Night Out. Page 6. There is finally a full frame of the house in which this sickening family montage was photographed. It is a modest one-story home on the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. The paint is a simple white, and it is beginning to flake from a simple picket fence that marked the perimeter. There are no other homes close by that are visible from the angle of the shot. In the left of the frame, the stables of the prized horses Mariam mentioned are visible in the background. The gates are wide open, and the horses are nowhere to be seen. Police cars, ambulances, and yellow crime scene tape blocks the rest of the view, except for the mailbox. The address on the mailbox? 6312 Prospect Road. The size of the frame indicate motion blur and plastic paneling. Mariam photographed this from a moving vehicle, likely from far away. The label reads, Sunday, the family gets to see policemen in action on career day. On the final page, Mariam is standing in front of my house with the package I'd just opened. The label, Thursday. Dropping off goodies for my favorite son. In that moment of realization, weakness took control of my body. Not just from the imagery I was subjected to, but from a sickening feeling that burned in my stomach and intestines. Words from earlier were ripping through my skull. You look just like my son. He and his daughter were found dead in Mariam's home last Friday. Poisoned. I forced myself to scan the backgrounds of those horrible pictures. On the first page, in Gracie's lap, was the cookie tin I'd just eaten from. This package was not from my mother. It was from a crazed mother who thought I was her son. Guided to my home from the business card I'd given her. Now, here we are. I don't think I have much time left. I'm starting to lose focus. My eyes are in a fervorous affair with the clock, and my focus is none the wiser. Maybe they'll get married and elope. I'll invite this dispatcher to the wedding if I make it through this. I vaguely realize that doesn't make sense, but I don't mind. I'm so tired, and now I can't stop coughing. I think I hear sirens in the distance, but I'm not sure if the ambulance has a cure for vomiting blood. Someone is coming up the stairs. I have to go now. Mariam is here, and she wants to give Gracie swimming lessons. Like many young men, I found myself unsatisfied with the monotony of a normal existence. My heart thirsted for adventure as I floundered about the crowded and dirty streets of New York, nearly suffocating from the unrealistic expectations bestowed upon me by my peers. A recent graduate of Harvard,
it was expected of me to find a place among society's elite. Over the past 250 years, my forebears had built the American academic prowess from the ground up. As the 19th century slowly gave way to the 20th, expectations to facilitate the continued growth of society flooded my waking hours. Before long, I found myself crushed beneath the mounting pressure and at my wit's end with educated society. The pompous attitudes and aristocratic demeanors drove me to the edge of my sanity. Resorting to ill-advised decisions at the tables and brothels, I longed for a reprieve from the poisonous lifestyle within which I found myself captive. Eventually, I allowed my emotions to steer my decisions. And that's why, in the matter of a few weeks, I found myself in the small mining town of Sharp Rock, thousands of miles from everything I'd ever known. The journey across the nation drained my pockets down to the pulp, but I'd never felt so full of energy in my entire life. Situated within the Rocky Mountains, Sharp Rock provided me with a freedom that I often feared I would never experience. The towering mountains juxtaposed with the beautiful prairies and sapphire blue lakes, capturing my heart upon first sight. My eyes ate up the gorgeous landscapes with a gluttonous fervor. However, my mouth was unable to follow suit, as I found myself going hungry within a few short weeks. The euphoric freedom was short-lived, as one can only truly appreciate the grand things in life when there's food in one's stomach. Lacking the requisite skills to survive among the vast wilderness, and the hardened folk that it housed, I began to starve. Panic started to set in as I began to understand the dire circumstances of my situation. I felt as if my stomach began to eat itself, and after a few days without a morsel of food, I reverted to treachery. I began stealing from those that I knew could not do without, but at that moment in time, my awareness for their well-being was buried so deep in my psyche, it may as well not even have existed. Desperation had grabbed the reins of my life, and I began to watch from the passenger seat as my existence began to veer heavily off course. In no grand length of time, I could hardly recognize myself. Covered in grime and emaciated, I felt myself longing for the stuffy atmosphere of New York City's intellectual circles. And trust me, that says more than I could ever hope to convey, as my disdain for the conceited academics coursed through every fiber of my body. Completely fed up with the enigma that had become my pitiful existence, I slung a rope over my bony shoulder and slowly made my way to the forest with a defeated gait. I do not believe it was a mystery to anyone in the town as to what I planned to do next. They had all seen it before. City folk like myself, biting off more than we can chew in the wild, lawless West. With my intentions as clear as day, the rope may as well have already been tied into a noose. I half wish someone would stop me from continuing with my plan, but everyone chose to watch my passing through the town and into the forest instead of intervening. Everyone, that is, except for George. "Oi, fellow, where are you off to?" asked a burly man. An obvious question, yet the look on the man's face showed that he already knew the answer. Stammering, I let out an incoherent concoction of noises. But my heart immediately leapt at the sound of his voice, and I felt a wave of relief wash over me. The idea of someone acknowledging my sorrows nearly brought me to tears. Overwhelmingly ashamed of my previous intentions, I began to sob. As I precipitated tears at a pace I would have previously deemed impossible, the man rose from his perch atop a rock and slowly sauntered his way over to me. If I'd seen this man in any other circumstance of my life, I would have been horrified of him, the way his brutish figure closed the gap between us. At this moment, however, I couldn't have been gladder to encounter his enormous self as he embraced me in a hug. I let the rope slip out of my hands as I reciprocated the hug, tears slowly saturating the man's vest. "I'm George. Everything's gonna be all right. What's your name?" he asked, his voice deeper than the greatest depths of the ocean. "Joseph, I managed to squeak out in between my sobs. Well, Joseph, I'm certainly glad I found you. There's no coming back from where you were headed. After an indistinguishable amount of time, clutched tightly to the only person in 1,000 miles who cared, I found myself meandering my way through the forest, following George to his camp on the outskirts of Sharp Rock. After a short stroll through the woods, we arrived at the camp. Populated with hardened gunslingers and mischievous thieves, I felt like a fraud among the people of the camp. George introduced me to the band of misfits, and it was evident in their tone that I was not welcome. However, their obvious reverence towards George acted as a buffer between their unpredictable selves and myself. I greatly appreciated George not divulging my pitiful story to his crew, even though it was obvious that I was a charity case. The men, as removed from proper society as they were not stupid, and they knew a lost soul when they saw one. In fact, I would argue that their time spent struggling against the elements only proved to sharpen their intellect. George led me over to a tent, the likes of which looked as if it were pitched at the dawn of time. I was surprised the structure remained standing as George ripped the flap out of the way, revealing a man fast asleep. "Mort!" George bellowed, his voice burrowing itself deep into the earth. The man rose abruptly from his slumber, visibly startled as he drew his knife, breathing hard. "Your new cellmate," George said, beckoning to me. Mort fell back onto the bed, breathing a sigh of relief, as there was no immediate threat looming at the entrance of the tent. Sitting up again after a brief moment, Mort looked me up and down as if he were going to take a bet on how long it would be before I croaked. The scowl etched along the man's face said enough. "I suppose I can share, at least for a week until he dies." "If he dies, you join him," said George. "Oh, you and your lost puppies, George," Mort retorted with a slow shake of his head. George only glared at the man before ducking his head out of the tent and walking back over towards the center of camp. "Every time I think I miss society, I run into sorry fellows like yourself, and I'm reminded why I left in the first place. It's a pleasure to meet you too," I grumbled. "You weren't born into this." "Nope, born and raised in Boston. Got out of there the first chance I could, though." "Ah, so you were once an esteemed member of society?" I asked, half-heartedly, as I began to prepare the cot with the blankets George had given me. "Hardly. More like I coexisted with society. I never felt a part of it. Nor did I want to. Society was something that happened around me, never to me. Too many people like yourself running around." I grunted, having finally finished making the cot. I didn't feel obliged to respond any longer to Mort, his personality wearing me thin after just a few short moments. I exited the tent without another word, making my way over to the fire where George had elected to sit. The sun slowly dripped its way behind the horizon, bathing the previously blue sky in a bloody golden hue. I did not say anything as I sat down at the fire, but my disgruntled demeanor must have uttered more than words ever could.
"Don't let Mort bother you," said George. "He's no different to any of the newcomers. Always giving him a hard time. Seeming to forget the hell that I pulled him from."
"A real welcome party you folks offer," I mumbled.
"But it's a better one than you would have received if you strung yourself up from that tree."
Any welcome party's better than none, I suppose."
"None? Well, I suppose it's up to what you believe in. Can't say I'm too surprised. You academics sure all think alike."
"What? You believe in an afterlife?"
"You're surprised?"
"Nope. Just curious."
"Well, I'm not too sure what I believe in, but whatever it is, it doesn't end in death. When you've seen the things I've seen, there's no denying that. Out here, under the pale glow of the moon, all of your rules dissolve. There's no telling what horrors or secrets the moon will reveal. Only that you'd be foolish to think so narrowly."
I shivered, the creeping cold exacerbated by George's sentiment.
If this place were as you thought, it'd be tame in comparison to its dark reality, George said.
We sat in silence for a few moments, lost to our own thoughts. The sun had finally set, and I watched the shadows from the fire dance across George's face in a chaotic yet mesmerizing manner. Something about the man's face kept me locked in a blank stare. It may have been awkward had I not been completely lost in my thoughts. Something about the man's appearance seemed strange to me, alien even, but I just could not... Suddenly an audible gasp shattered my hazy concentration, my breath catching in the back of my throat. George sat there, seemingly unbothered by my reaction. He simply seemed used to the shock. Dangling from beneath his cap were two earlobes. Now, this would have been perfectly normal, had there not already been two ears below the earlobes. George had four ears.
Took you long enough. Smart as you college lot are, you're not always the most observant bunch. George chuckled slightly.
I truly didn't notice your oddities. I'm sorry, I said, looking downwards.
Sorry for what? Asked George.
Well, I imagine growing up must not have been easy. School must have been dreadful.
Growing up was not easy. With school, I never had the luxury of attending school.
I don't know if I'd go as far as to call it a luxury, I said.
You would if you found yourself facing the alternatives. You ever been to the circus?
Once or twice.
Then you'll know what someone with my, how did you put it? Oddities,
yeah.
Well, someone with my oddities is in high demand.
All you need's a hat, and no one would know any different.
My mother knew different. And that's all that mattered. Plus, it's a little bit more difficult to hide this.
He looked up, revealing one massive nostril, followed by him opening his hands, revealing six fingers on each hand. How had I not noticed any of this before?
George looked as if he were the result of an inside joke among higher deities.
He began to divulge the childhood hell that he'd experienced with the traveling circus. However, I do not feel I have the liberty to repeat this story. Well, not yet, anyway.
George's past made even the most ludicrous of upbringings look docile in comparison.
Over the course of the next few hours, I felt that I began to know George better than anyone I'd ever met. He'd seen me in my most vulnerable state, and felt that it was only right to even the scales. Over the course of the next few months, I slowly ingratiated myself into the collective that was George's gang. A gang that George never provided with a name, even at the behest of the crew.
Now, any rival gangs aware of George's less-than-ideal history refer to our motley crew as the Travelin' Circus, and the name had stuck well before I ever plot my sorry ass with a lot of them. Whether the name bothered George, he would never say, but I can imagine it didn't sit well with him at first, especially after becoming privy to pieces of his story. Nevertheless, George was different from most men.
While many people fall victim to their wretched histories, George had used his to fuel the fire burning deep within him. Regardless of his original feelings of the attempted slander, George now wore the distinction with a badge of honor, as did the crew. Never in my life had I met an individual who commanded so much respect, not just from his own crew, but many others spread throughout the plains and the mountains. Well, as a gifted intellectual myself, my less-than-fortunate parents pushed me into every scholarly circle they could find, leaving me with no choice but to obey, lest I receive the belt. Throughout my education, I found myself a part of countless intellectual societies, each void of any real and meaningful connection. I'd grown up to accept the fact that I would never truly belong to any collective, least of all an outlaw gang. Life, however, seems to have a peculiar way of delivering you to the things you desire the most. As outlandish a thought as this may have seemed earlier in my life, I consider myself blessed to have fallen into the enormous hands of George and his traveling circus, even if it ultimately led to my untimely demise. George stepped up to the roaring fire, situated at the center of the camp, wheeling coal in tow. The rest of the gang, myself included, had already found our way beside the fire, the creeping freeze of winter slowly infringing upon the crisp fall air. Mort sat to my left, grumbling to himself incoherently as he fumbled with the elk meat roasting over the inferno. Courtesy of Mort and Lucas, the hunt earlier in the day had proved fruitful, the savory smell of the roasting meat wafting around our hungry selves in a devious taunt, as we all knew how long it took to cook the sinewy beast properly. An irritable man for sure, Mort almost made up for his lack of common decency with his uncanny ability to transform the wilderness around him into mouth-watering meals. The fear I'd come to associate with hunger during my initial inhabitants of the West slowly exercised itself from my thoughts as I became more trusting of the steady food supply and more comfortable in sharing the table with the other folks. "News from the Union," said George, beckoning towards Cole, who scampered up behind him. Cole was a jumpy little fellow, born of the gold rush and raised in just about every saloon and brothel west of the Rockies. His mother came to the West with all the right intentions, but found herself selling her assets shortly thereafter. Cole was a product of her occupation and thus had never met his father. A quiet man at heart, the lack of any stability in his life only proved to exacerbate his personality, turning him into a full recluse. At the mercy of an unenvious lifestyle, Cole unearthed the secret to passing through life unheard and unseen, thus ripening his candidacy for an outlaw crew such as the Traveling Circus. No matter how much brawn, muscle, and determination the outlaw life boasted, the services of a quiet, non-threatening individual capable of eavesdropping on nearly all conversations was invaluable. "There was a battle earlier today, not far from here. No more than 10 miles south of Lucky," said Cole, partially stepping out of George's shadow created by the blaze. "Another massacre, I'm sure," replied Lucas, eyes still fixated on the roasting elk, a noticeable sadness in his tone. Half Sioux himself, Lucas held a deep resolve for the tribesfolk, with whom he shared blood.
"This was different," replied Cole. "I suppose, battle is the incorrect term. It was an ambush. A collective of Cheyenne and Arapaho attacked a supply train headed further west towards California." With a brief pause that may have been mistaken for dramatic purpose, were it someone else speaking, Cole continued. "A supply train led by none other than General McKeever." With this, the crew perked up, finally giving Cole the attention his passive disposition struggled to earn.
"A McKeever?" asked Mort. "Filled with arrows," answered Cole.
"Dead?"
asked Jeb, seemingly unable to read between the lines.
"Very," replied Cole.
Widely regarded as the devil himself by the indigenous tribes, General McKeever earned himself a dastardly and feared reputation as the scorn of the natives. A ruthless tactician and brutal man, McKeever drew the ire of any good-natured folk throughout the nation, outlaws, academics, and natives alike. Unfortunately for the natives, McKeever's band lacked such individuals.
"Serves that bastard right," said Lucas.
"Hope it wasn't too quick."
"Well, we should get a move on before the field's picked clean," said Jeb, rising to his feet.
Even in my hunger, my stomach gave a quick twist as thoughts of sifting through the bloodied, mutilated dead flooded my mind.
"We are no longer scavengers," George said, his voice rumbling authoritatively.
Jeb sat back down tentatively, allowing George to continue.
"But we are not going to let this opportunity pass us by either. Cole over here got wind of a funeral train returning the dead officers to the East Coast. A train that'll be passing directly through Jordan's Cut."
"Our territory," said Mort, thoughtful.
"Aye," said George.
Where is this headed? Interjected Lucas. Rob their coffins? Ransom, I responded, finally entering the conversation and believing I knew George's intention.
Aye, we hold the bodies for ransom, said George, a proud glint written across his face.
The same look a father might give his son at the success of his son's first hunt.
Lucas shook his head.
Those bodies will be cursed. If there's one thing I know about my ancestors, they would not let such men walk into the afterlife with ease. Don't interrupt the curse.
Cursed? How? I asked,
my thoughts reverting to my first extensive conversation with George.
Well, if this General McKeever was as horrid as the stories make him out to be, I have my suspicions as to what they might do to him, replied Lucas.
Why should we have any concern for a curse placed on another man? Asked Mort.
Is it not uncommon for these curses to inflict collateral damage? Responded Lucas.
What are your suspicions? I asked, ignoring Mort's input, my interest slowly encroaching upon my wariness.
Eternal damnation. Except, not the way Christianity would have you believe. General McKeever will never go to hell. Instead, they'll bring hell to him, Lucas said.
Oh, my educated mind tried everything it could to ignore the implausibility of what Lucas was saying. However, my curiosity could not be satiated, my expression stating all that was required for Lucas to continue.
Well, I'm sure you're all aware of scalping, however, I doubt you're privy to its origins.
Origins that differ greatly from the common understanding. An understanding rooted in the basic idea that a warrior or hunter is entitled to the trophies of its prey. Trophy collecting has transcended time and cultures alike, but more often than not, its inception hints at a darker beginning, said Lucas. And the natives are no exception.
Well, Christianity does not have a monopoly on its belief in hell, although the specific structure of eternal damnation varies across cultural lines. Instead of sending the soul deep into the depths of the earth, many of my forebears believe you could create hell within the body itself, trapping the soul within its own corpse to suffer for eternity. For those special individuals who earn a place amongst the truly evil, the removal of the scalp unlocks the canvas for which to create hell within the body. Once the ritual is complete, the reattachment of the scalp locks the soul within the newly crafted perdition. Over time, the practice of scalping changed as warriors collected the scalps of their enemies as a testament to their ferocity in battle, as the old ways provided no evidence. But even now, albeit a rare occurrence, some still revert to the ancient practice when deemed appropriate.
After a long pause, gracefully allowing us to digest the entire story, Lucas added one last thing. I repeat myself, do not interrupt the curse. For our own good, let this opportunity slide.
Don't pay this any heed, interrupted Mort.
Cursed or no, those bodies will fetch us a pretty penny. It's not the first time we've ever been threatened with an Indian curse, and I very much doubt it'll be the last.
Although I do not wish to ignore your concern, Lucas, I must stand with Mort. The benefits much outweigh the risks, said George.
I would worry more about stopping the rain.
Out of everyone, I would have expected you to not brush this off so lightly, especially given your, less than ideal history, Lucas said to George, seemingly disappointed, even surprised.
Now, if George had one flaw, it was his bullhead attitude towards danger. Granted, that stubborn, reckless, even dare I say foolish attitude was the reason he dug himself from that atrocity of a childhood. However, it had also thrown the gang into precarious situations more than once. Situations that, by the good graces of luck, we'd always escape from. George, however, refused to acknowledge the luck involved, instead deeming it his right to walk away unscathed. And after what that man had been through and survived, who were we to blame him? Hell, we even began to believe him ourselves. But when you provoke danger for too long, it has no choice but to bite back. And bite back it did. We slowly made our way up to the bridge, methodically traversing the menacing path through the mountains. At long last, we approached the bridge, the view from the cliffside expanding into oblivion. Far beneath us, fog drifted across the lake, the heavy mist only visible by the moon's glow peeking from behind the clouds. Silence enveloped the mountainous surroundings, our lanterns providing the only light save for the skeletal hue of the moon. We waited in anxious anticipation for the mechanical drone of the train in the distance, our breath crystallizing into swirling patterns before us. It never came. Even in the cold, my hands began to sweat the longer I waited. As the wait lengthened, my adrenaline slowly began to abandon me, leaving me cold, dark fear in its wake. What had I gotten myself into? Finally, a light appeared on the other end of the tracks, climbing its way through the winding mountain tracks towards the bridge. My heart exploded into a diabolic pace as my grip strangled my pistol. I could sense all the others stiffening as well at the sight of the light. Interestingly, no noise of the approaching train reached my ears. Well, I chalked that up to the thundering of my heart, as I could hardly even hear myself breathe. Looking about the group, however, it was evident that I was not the only one experiencing this uneasy feeling, but then again, robbing a train doesn't necessarily put your heart at ease. Once the train began to cross the bridge, George gave a slight nod to Mort, who began to mobilize the carriage. The goal was to time the blockade so that it stranded the train helplessly while crossing the bridge. I glanced at Mort as he began to push the carriage from behind the cover of the mountain towards the tracks. Now, as a band of outlaws, we were no strangers to committing heinous acts, robbing trains being the least of them. But not once since joining it had I ever seen the look that Mort returned to me. It was a look of pure vacillation. I'd never known a man more resolute in his decision-making than Mort, so seeing the reluctance etched across his face frightened me to my core. After a noticeable hesitation, Mort drew the carriage across the tracks at the end of the bridge and then climbed onto the roof, waving two lanterns. Paying no heed to the wagon blocking the tracks, the train continued barreling towards the blockade. In an attempt to further incentivize the halt of the train, Mort threw both lanterns at the wagon below him, igniting it instantly. Bearing down upon the inferno, the train still did not make any attempt to stop. At the last moment, Mort jumped from the burning wagon just as the train collided with the improvised bonfire, shattering the strange silence with an ear-splitting carnage. I hit the ground no different than I would have if I were one of those unfortunate souls on the field at Gettysburg. A fireball engulfed the front of the train as wooden splinters shot out like cannon fire. I lay there dazed and confused, the world seeming to move around me in slow motion. Next to me, Cole observed his chest with near fascination as a spear-like splinter of wagon jutted from his body. He looked at the wound as if it were not inflicted upon him, but upon someone else. In a pitiful look of confusion, he glanced at me before tumbling over, shoving the debris further into him. I grimaced, looking away. Suddenly, I felt my collar yanked upward. Turning, I saw George perched atop his horse like that of a war general. And he may as well have been, since it was evident that he'd declared war upon that blasted train. My horse stood beside him as he beckoned me to join him on his quest. Climbing atop the horse, George gave me no time for reprieve as he was already barreling alongside the train. In a moment entirely devoid of any thought, I chased after him in reckless abandon. The frigid, mountainous squalls tore at my face and lungs as the steed accelerated in frantic pursuit of both George and the runaway locomotive. With the train acting as a barrier between the luminescence of the moon and our frenzied chase, the dim glow hidden within each of the boxcars provided the only light for our pursuit. The inopportune darkness only fed the utter insanity of the chase, as I clenched my teeth in violent anticipation of the boulder that never came. And in yet another tale of George's invincibility, we clambered onto a slightly agape boxcar nearer to the back of the train. The fury and chaos from the preceding chase dissipated almost instantly as we pulled ourselves aboard the runaway behemoth. Small oil lamps hung along the damp wooden walls, providing a muggy illumination of the cargo stored within the boxcar. I began to wipe my eyes, only then starting to realize how much they'd watered while riding headfirst into the Highland gales. At any other point in my life, I would have welcomed the calmness that presided over the train. However, at this moment, something seemed amiss. Something was not right with this train. A quick glance at George next to me confirmed that the feelings were mutual. "We'll be across the country before long at this pace. Get up front and stop the train," George said, obviously doing his best to ignore his creeping reservations. Clearly having less of a grip on my own reservations, I grunted a pitiful acknowledgement, turning away and heading towards the locomotive. Methodically, I worked my way through the long queue of cars that led up to the head of the train. Each car resembled the last. Silent storage cars lined with oil lamps and filled to the brim with various cargo, and each car reverberated a clammy warmth in distinct contrast to the biting cold of the mountains outside. I gradually became aware of a trickling sweat, the source of which originated just above my brow. Each salty bead trickled slowly and ever so maddeningly down my face until their grip failed, tumbling off the crest of my chin, clearing the way for their counterparts. As unnerving as the calmness was, I could not help but appreciate the lack of a firefight that usually accompanied such an act. It was not every day you robbed an unguarded train. I considered myself lucky. And that was when I noticed it. The smell. At first, it was just the unpleasant smell of burnt hair that wafted towards me. But before long, a much harsher, stronger, more potent smell reared its ugly head. Burnt flesh. The hair on the back of my neck stood on edge, emitting a chill down my spine. I felt my eyes slowly bulge out of my sockets and all my senses heighten as the adrenaline floodgates open wide once again. To my surprise, the smell of smoke never joined the army of olfactory horror that had taken control of the train. Where had I smelled this before? Venturing deep into the archives of my brain, I dug around aimlessly until finally happening upon a rather unpleasant memory. Lacking the structure of a more robust memory, all I could see, or smell, was the small crematorium tucked away in the alley behind my parents' old apartment building. That, along with my curiosity as to why all those people on their little beds entered but would never leave, I remember my fascination as to how the building could hold so many people if no one ever left. The mind of a young boy remains innocent even when the answers are staring you directly in the face. Vague memory or no, the smell was unmistakably that of a crematorium. But why was there a crematorium on a... And then it hit me. And I genuinely wish it hadn't, because what followed has not left me since, nor will it ever. With a newfound sense of purpose, I continued my way through the last collection of cars leading towards the front of the train. In a few short minutes, the smell went from noticeable to nauseating. Hiding my nose beneath my shirt, I approached the furnace car, sure of what I was going to find. But no matter how hard you try, nothing can prepare you for the sight of a half-charred corpse. Especially if your corpse is actually three corpses. I staggered back, shirt still covering my nose, the intense heat reaching out at me, as if it were inviting me to join. The crackle of hot coals within became the only audible noise as I stood there trying to comprehend the situation. Unfortunately, the situation sat far outside the realm of comprehension. Each corpse lay next to the other, no different from soldiers in barracks. One next to the other, lying on their backs, arms to their sides. Had the skin not been melting off their bones, it would have been easy to mistake the unfortunate trio as asleep rather than dead. Better yet, the furnace showed no signs of struggle. It seemed as if the poor souls, with the absence of any proper bedding, had opted to take a nap in the cozy confines of the furnace. A nap they would certainly not awaken from, or so I hoped. My every thought grasped desperately at any semblance of reality, only for my grip to falter with each attempt. Maybe they'd died before being shoved into the furnace, I finally thought to myself, unsure of whether it was aloud or within my head. That seemed the only viable explanation. Standing ajar behind me, the door to the conductor's cabin begged for further investigation. I stepped into the cabin and, staring me in the face, was the slender, bronze lever that, if pulled, would bring the train to a screeching halt. It was then I finally remembered what had brought me to the front of the train in the first place. Without hesitation, I pulled the lever. Lurching forward at the sudden halt of momentum, I caught myself before bashing against the front of the cabin. Outside the window of the cockpit, I could see the sparks bursting up from the steel tracks, teeming with the shriek of the skidding stop. I could only hope George had braced himself for the sudden stop. Having stopped the train, I allowed myself once again to focus on the incredulity at hand. I surveyed the cabin with the hopes of finding even the smallest hint of struggle among the more obvious signs of foul play. To my increasing disbelief, everything seemed in order, and there were none of the telltale signs such as bullet casings, blood, or broken objects. Not allowing myself to believe the unbelievable, I became frantic in my search for evidence, only to find myself exasperated by the end of my effort. Feeling my sanity slipping with every passing second, I finally peeled myself from the foolhardy investigation and began to work my way back towards George, now that I'd finally stopped the train. I walked back through the train in a trance-like state, shaking uncontrollably, my feeble attempts to quell the tremors proving unsuccessful. At long last, the screech of the untimely halt of the train dwindled away, placated. Once again, silence slithered its way onto the train, save for the muffled howling of the wind. Further losing my grip on sanity with each step I took and each identical boxcar I entered and exited, I tried instead to focus once again on the near convulsions that vied for control over my body. Well, it may seem silly, but breathing patterns I once used to calm myself during my time at Harvard began to calm my nerves. A few boxcars later, I felt that I once again had control over my body. I continued to shiver and my fear still sickened me, but I felt that my leaking sanity had finally congealed. No matter how hard I tried, however, I could not rid my mind of the charred corpses, staring complacently at the molten ceiling of the furnace. I continued through a handful more boxcars until I came to the daunting realization that I couldn't tell which of the cars George and I had originally boarded. With each vacant car I walked through, a distant sense of panic crept its way back to the surface. I must have passed our original car 10 cars ago, I thought to myself. Where was George? I began to accelerate my pace with each empty car I passed through. I could feel panic unveiling its unwelcome presence once again, a lump forming in my throat and my mouth going dry. It seemed as if my palm stole all the moisture from my mouth, my hands again becoming clammy and my heart beating with rapid succession. A feeling of dread washed over me, the same dread that accompanies a small child lost in the woods. With each new boxcar absent of George, I felt myself growing increasingly frantic. Discipline faltering, my mind wandered to the forlorn corners of my conscience. I allowed my previously resolute demeanor to devolve into harrowing thoughts of George, convincing myself of his dreadful demise. Finally, as I pushed through the next door in my seemingly eternal queue of train cars, I saw the enormous figure of George squeeze through the door at the opposite end of the car. I called his name a moment too late as the door shut behind him. I began after him, my previous thoughts and fears about George falling by the wayside. I felt a little foolish that I doubted the man's ability to fend for himself. As I walked through the car, I could not help but notice that the cargo differed from other cars I'd passed through. I did not offer it much attention, with my focus glued to the door at the opposite end, until it finally hit me. The boxes were coffins. This did not surprise me, as I was more than aware of the cargo housed within some of the boxcars, but it unsettled me nonetheless. I knew that just beneath each lid lay the mangled remains of some godforsaken young man. Just the thought released a shiver down my spine. As I continued walking through the car, a small irregularity with one of the coffins caught my eye, dragging my attention away from the original objective once again. I'm still unsure of how my attention fell upon such a minute detail, but on the side of one of the coffins to my right was a small hole, just large enough to fit a finger. Lying beside the coffin were a few tiny splinters that must have come from the creation of the hole. I would never have noticed these splinters had I not first noticed the hole, as the splinters were hardly more than lonely scraps of sawdust. As hard as I tried to depress the morbid curiosity rising deep within me, I could not resist. The lid of the wooden coffin slid off with ease, tumbling to the floor with a muffled thud. Staring directly up at me was a relaxed yet blank stare of a young man. Ripped from my lungs, my breath surrendered itself to the surprise of seeing the young man stare. Obviously, I knew exactly what lay inside the coffin, but why would they leave his bloodshot eyes open to gaze endlessly upon the underside of the lid? I noticed another oddity. Blood caked the right side of the man's face and the inner wall of the coffin, the epicenter of which was the hole that originally caught my attention. Confusion and fear assaulted my thoughts in alternating waves. My first thought, admittedly drivel, was that the young man was buried alive and could not escape, thus killing himself. However, remembering the ease with which I had removed the lid, that disproved that theory. Examining the unfortunate soul, I tried my best to distinguish his unit. However, his uniform differed from what I'd come to expect of the military. It seemed more humble. Like burying the poor boy was a last-second decision. A decision made with the understanding that the soldier lacked the proper burial attire or posthumous attention. This man was not a soldier. He was one of the men assigned to guard the train and its cargo. I finally thought, dread ambushing my conscience in a fury. Suddenly an observation I'd subconsciously repressed emerged from the depths of my mind. The coffin seemed much deeper from the outside than it did while gazing upon the body it housed. The man, it seemed, floated on top of some entity within the coffin. An entity, I realized a moment later, in the form of another body. Moving entirely by instinct, I shoved the stiff corpse to the side of the coffin, revealing an older, much more decadent corpse beneath. This man was most certainly a soldier per his traditional funeral garb. His closed eyes resembled a peaceful slumber, while any mortal wounds the man had suffered remained hidden. I let go of the fresh corpse, allowing it to slump back on top of the soldier. To my ever-increasing terror, I noticed that the coffin surrounding me also bore similar holes to the coffin I'd examined. This is where the guards went. My thoughts rushed back to the furnace where it seemed the drivers of the train had willingly offered themselves up to the inferno housed within. No matter how fervently I tried to downplay the unbelievable events from the past 20 minutes, I could no longer feign disbelief at the obvious suicides. Suicides that seemed to have occurred without second thought. My academic mind finally reverted to hysteria as the preceding events and discoveries became too much to handle. I ran from coffin to coffin, ripping off the lids only to find that each coffin housed not only a properly groomed corpse, but a fresh, bloodied corpse stacked on top as well. The last semblance of sanity fell from my grasp, never to return. After an indistinguishable amount of time, I slowly stumbled out of the cabin, exhausted and disturbingly carefree, all ties to sanity mercifully severed. Leaving bloodied handprints on each door I'd pushed through, I resumed my odyssey through the train, an admittedly shell-shocked gait to my usually sure-footedness. I began to sweat once again, the salty beads dribbling down my chin and, well, these droplets were different, more viscous. I was not sweating, but drooling. Upon my realization, I simply let the saliva tumble from the barriers of my lips, the stringy viscosity undulating like that of a pendulum with each snap. Peculiarly, my insanity did nothing to quell my awareness, only instead acting to dissolve my ability to read as would be deemed normal. Suddenly I reached the final car, directly before the caboose. Had I still contained the capacity for emotion, I may have emitted some surprise. I'd finally come to the passive acceptance that the forsaken locomotive stretched on for an eternity. However, the horror-scratched window peering out into the abyssal darkness spoke to another truth. A figure stood out on the caboose, gazing off into the distance, appearing to look at nothing in particular. A figure that could be none other than George. Had I forgotten about George? In my panic and eventual retreat from sanity, I begrudgingly realized that not only had I forgotten about the mission at hand, but also I hardly even remembered I was not alone. The groan of the wind masked the screech of the hinges as I pushed through the door leading out onto the caboose deck. Offering a slight acknowledgement of my presence, George nodded, his gaze still fixed upon the blackness beyond. Shrouded behind the seemingly random migrations of clouds, the moon found itself held captive by the ever-thickening mists. George's figure remained backlit by the small lamp hung just outside the door, further rendering any reliable view beyond the caboose impossible. I stood there for a long moment, in the quiet presence of my burly friend. Neither of us said anything, but despite the silence and the void that had replaced my sanity, I found it comfortable to find myself among the living once again. "Did you see him?" George asked. "See who?" I responded, finally wiping the drool from my chin. "The General," replied George. I don't believe so," I muttered in response, my mind scrambling back through the seemingly impossible memories. "Did you?" George took his time before answering, but the look in his eye as he turned to face me told me all I needed to know. "Aye," he managed to say. Now that he was facing me, I noticed that he carried what looked like a furry animal in the dim lighting. It was a few moments later that I actually realized what he held in his hands. It was a bloody tuft of hair. A scalp. "And I found this at the bottom of his coffin," he said, tossing the scalp towards me. I stood there, staring at the gnarled and bloody scalp, speechless. I slowly raised my gaze to meet George's once again, a moment of clarity materializing between the two of us. George gave a brief nod as if to acknowledge my thoughts. The reverberating rumble of the train crossing a bridge became audible as the train began to span a valley buried beneath the depths of the darkness below, yielding any guesses as to the bridge's height futile at best. To my eternal surprise, George said nothing else to further the conversation. He simply turned, looking at me with a blank expression, a complacent look plastered on his face. He looked at me, and I at him. I held his gaze, trying to decipher his bizarre demeanor, but his expression was airtight. "George," I asked feebly, worried for what might follow. For the briefest of moments, a hint of reservation crossed his docile expression, only to return almost instantaneously to his previous disposition. George no longer looked to be in control of himself, in spite of his legendary resolve. Without further hesitation, George cast himself from the caboose, the complacency never leaving his face, as his would-be corpse fell rigidly, almost peacefully, into the night. Well, I was more than aware that I should have felt stunned at the unprovoked suicide of my savior, but I couldn't muster the surprise, or any emotion for that matter. Instead, I just stood there, staring out at the expanse as George had done moments before. Slowly, one emotion crept its way from the cavern of my existence. Curiosity. And so once again, we reach the end of tonight's podcast. My thanks as always to the authors of those wonderful stories, and to you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'd ask one small favor of you. Wherever you get your podcast from, please write a few nice words and leave a 5-star review, as it really helps the podcast. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again same time, same place, and I do so hope you'll join me once more. Until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.